Before I begin, I wanted to let you know that earlier this morning, a dove decided to enter the sanctuary on Pentecost Sunday. We're not quite sure what that means, but the dove right now is patiently resting atop the columbarium in the back of the sanctuary. Seems content to do so, but we all know how the Spirit moves. And if the Spirit chooses to move in this service, I wanted you to be aware and not be alarmed that the dove is there. It does make a preacher somewhat nervous to know. It happened some years ago, but the embarrassment that comes with the memory is still fairly fresh. I'm thinking of the morning I stopped by my local grocery store in North Carolina to pick up just one item on my way to an appointment. I was running a little behind schedule, so I dashed into the store, I found the item, and I hurried on to the checkout. Of course, there were lines at the checkout counters, so I chose one of the self-checkout scanners. I scanned my first and only item and placed it in the bag as instructed by the disembodied voice from the checkout machine. After a moment, the computer said again, "Please scan your first item and place it in the bag." "I did already," I said to no one in particular. But then I noticed that the purchase wasn't showing on the screen, and so I scanned it again. Nothing. And I heard again, "Please scan your first item and place it in the bag." And then I began just going kind of crazy. I scanned it again and several times more until at last the purchase showed up on the screen. 7 times. It was at that point, I think, that I let out an audible sigh, whereupon the woman who was overseeing the operation walked over and said, "That's all right, honey, just let it out. Just let it all out." And then she did something to clear the scanner, and I started over, and this time, of course, the scanner worked perfectly, and I was grateful and mortified. I thought to myself on the way to my appointment that day that I'd probably been sighing a good deal that morning. I know something about sighs. I did raise 2 children through adolescence, after all. Sometimes I think we intend our sighs to be dramatic. And at other times, as Shannon Kirshner says, sighs can simply be the body's way of compensating for stress. Its way of making us breathe deeply when we're so hard at it that we may forget to breathe. Apparently, when we experience stress in our lives, we breathe more shallow breaths. And so our bodies compensate for the lack of oxygen by making us sigh. Our bodies force us to take a deep breath. We sigh when the stressful pace gets to us, when the last paper is finished and the last test taken and graduation and the next big step loom before us, when we sit at the hospital bedside with a loved one who is struggling so and we find ourselves unable to help, when we sit before the headlines of the day and we find deep weariness and a measure of despair creeping in, when the toll of life together makes us question the promises that we made one to another. In such moments, our sighs may be our body's way of forcing us to take a deep breath, but they may also express more about our interior lives than words alone can say. Many of our sighs, I believe, are prayers without words, prayers we simply breathe instead of say. So this week, preparation for Pentecost, I return to the claim of the Apostle Paul that God helps us in our weakness at the very point where we find ourselves breathless and intercedes with sighs too deep for words. It's a remarkable thing to say, and whatever it means exactly, it is a profound word of comfort and a wonderful affirmation about the Holy Spirit for this Pentecost Sunday. I like the way it echoes and responds to Paul's language a couple of verses earlier about the groaning of creation. We know that the whole creation has been groaning in labor pains until now, Paul said, and not only the creation, but we ourselves. The entire creation is groaning, says Paul, in labor pains, and then connects that groaning with the groaning of the Spirit. Interesting to note that in Greek, groaning and sighing are the same word. My guess is that anyone who has experienced labor pains would say that groaning is probably the better word choice. The Lutheran pastor Heidi Newmark said once that when she was in labor, she didn't offer up many sweet little sighs. Paul's not speaking of sweet sighs here either. The biblical scholar N.T. Wright says the groaning of the church in the midst of the groaning world is sustained and even inspired by the groaning of the Spirit. Those who cannot see that for which they eagerly hope need assistance to peer into the darkness that seems to be ahead and pray God's future into the present. If it is that assistance that the Spirit provides. The point Paul is making is that the Spirit's very own self intercedes with the Christian precisely at the point where he or she, faced with the ruin and misery of the world, finds out that there are no words left to express the sense of futility and the longing for redemption. It is not, as some early scribes added to the text, that the Spirit intercedes for us. That misses the point. What Paul is saying is that the Spirit, active within the innermost being of the Christian person, is doing the very interceding the Christian longs to do, even though the only evidence that can be produced is inarticulate groaning and sighing. The Spirit's sighs and groans thus collaborate with our own. In solidarity, the Spirit voices our own longing for redemption, confirming both the painful reality of the present and the hopeful future that lies beyond the reality. Roman scholar Paul Meyer once said that the gift of the Spirit help fill that gap between present reality and future hope, giving us reason for some confidence. That gap didn't begin with us. It was clearly part of the experience of the first disciples, too. My pastor friend Shannon Kirshner got me thinking about the ways that Spirit took up the sighs and groaning of the disciples, too, as they eyed the gap between all that they saw and all that they hoped for, and felt little confidence as that first Pentecost day arrived. By this point in their journey, the disciples were probably quite breathless themselves, she said. Remember all that has happened in the last 50 days for them. Jesus' goodbye, his arrest, his crucifixion, then his resurrection, his continued ministry with them. And then, just as the disciples began to catch their breath, Jesus did as he said he would. He left. He was taken out of their sight, returned to the one from whom he came. It must have been heart-wrenching. The wind was simply knocked out of them again. I bet they sighed loudly with stress and fear, Kirshner said, the web of chaos winding around their throats. And so the disciples did what all church people do in times of fear and chaos. They held a meeting. They began to try to get their game plan together. There was much to do, after all. They needed to get organized. They needed to choose more apostles to help them with the work that Jesus had left for them. After all, they were now supposed to tell others about what God had done in Jesus. It was a daunting mission before them. They could not believe they were now the ones in charge of continuing Jesus' ministry to the outcast, to the poor, to the powerful, to the sick, all without his physical presence. It was enough to leave them breathless. But before they knew what was happening, out of the blue, they heard a mighty wind heading their way. The wind blew through the whole house, filling each of them with a breath that came from somewhere else, from someone else. Breath filled them with a power they didn't understand. They had not asked for this breath, nor had they expected it. This power, this breath, this courage just swooped into the room and filled them up in a way that could never have predicted, offering them a reserve of strength they did not know they possessed. They came face to face, lung to lung, with the gift of God's Holy Spirit, God's holy breath. The Spirit intercedes with sighs too deep for words, says the Apostle Paul. That holy breath makes it clear, as David Bartlett once said, that our prayers to God really begin with God and end with God, which ties us to a larger truth in Romans, which is that our lives begin and our lives end with God. God's holy breath, which we have known in more subtle ways, perhaps, came dramatically on that Pentecost in Jerusalem. That first wave of apostles felt directly a great reserve of strength, which was then amplified and compounded by the inspired energy of the community, which is to say, it became a combined strength in those days, as it is today. Heidi Newmark, whose experience with the groans of childbirth I mentioned earlier, remembers something else about that birthing experience. I remember, she said, the importance of my husband's hands during my labor. I held on tightly the entire time. I recall my horror when a nurse suggested, after about 10 hours of labor, that maybe it would be good for Gregorio to get himself a cup of coffee. Good, I thought. Was she insane? It was just awful to release his hand for even a moment. By the end of that labor, his hand was colored with bruises as evidence of my grip and of his steadfast love entwined with mine. In a larger sense, of course, the same is true of any important labor of love in this groaning world. Indeed, as Newmark says, the labor required for us to be Christ's ambassadors of healing and wholeness in this world requires the steadfast grasp of many hands willing to stretch out, touch, and bear the bruises of struggle. It's hard work. It's hard work. This month we celebrate such hard work. The contractions that enlarge our hearts and minds and stretch open our systems and our structures for new life produce groaning and pain. And yet, says Paul, I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worth comparing to the glory about to be revealed to us. It is confidence and hope in that glory and in the redemption of our own lives and of God's creation that keeps Christ's church moving forward. The ground of such confidence and hope is the gift of the Holy Spirit and the transforming power from God that enables us to see new life coming to birth where others see only disaster and decay, that enables us to see resurrection, as it were, where others see only the triumph of darkness and death. A friend suggests that in light of Paul's letter to the Romans and Paul's testimony of the Spirit's solidarity with us, maybe at Pentecost it would be best to leave all the tongues of fire banners, all the red balloons and pinwheels that churches seem to pull out of the storage closet every year, that as odd as it seems, maybe the better thing to do might be to pull out the Advent wreath and light once again that candle of hope. Paul makes no mention of Pentecost, or Advent for that matter, but Paul does make it clear that the community created by God's Spirit is an Advent community. We are defined by what is yet to come, by a hope for that which we have not yet seen. Of course, in this wrinkle of time between now and then, along with the whole creation, we still groan. We still sigh. We still ache for the day of wholeness and peace and redemption. We still struggle toward that day. But it is our firm conviction that we are not alone. We are not alone. We have each other, and we have the Holy Spirit. And as the Apostle says, the Spirit helps us in our weakness. For we do not know how to pray as we ought. But that very Spirit intercedes with sighs too deep for words. That, friends, is a promise.